Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio is the FT's chief regulation correspondent, Brooke Masters, and Daniel Schaefer, investment banking correspondent. This week, we'll take a look at the FSA's ban and fines on ex-UBS advisors being upheld.
This is the final, we think, twist in a really long-running six-year saga.
We'll discuss Barclays' plans to sell its entire stake in BlackRock.
The main reason really why they're selling it is that under the incoming Basel III capital regulations, it's going to be just prohibitively expensive to own such a stake in another financial holding company.
And finally, we'll look at the Bank of England and the shock news, really, that there is going to be, after all, an investigation into their handling of the 2008 crisis.
They're not just reviewing what happened in the crisis. They're doing three crucial reviews for their future responsibilities as bank regulators.
First, though, to UBS. Brooke, we've just had news that a former wealth management desk head at UBS has been fined over £1 million and banned from working in the UK over this unauthorised trading debacle. Just remind us what exactly happened and how big this is in terms of news.
This is the final, we think, twist in a really long-running six-year saga dating back to basically 2006-2007 when UBS discovered that its Asia 2 desk, which was essentially a desk serving rich clients based in India and Pakistan and that part of the world, had utter control failures. And among other things, they were making trades randomly and then booking them to accounts depending on how they did. UBS paid an £8 million fine in 2009 over this. At that time, that was quite a big fine. They've since gotten tougher at the FSA, but back then it was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. This is the desk head. His name is Sachin Karpe. He's been fined quite a large fine for an individual. And the reason it's taken so long is he has fought the case all the way to the tribunal, which is the first real judicial body. Although he has now said, having lost to the tribunal, he's not going to take it to court. So this should be done.
So this should draw a line under the whole escapade, because it's obviously not particularly pleasant for the bank to be dragged through the mire on this all the time, but also for Mr. Karpe, who's presumably doing something else now.
Yeah, he was fired for cause from UBS. Yes, he is not an authorized person at the moment.
No.
With any luck, UBS can now say we're done with this set of unauthorized trading. Of course, we have the next set of unauthorized trading coming up.
Yeah, I was going to ask Daniel about that, actually, because that's obviously going to dominate the coverage of UBS in the news over the summer when Kweku Adeboli is coming to trial.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem for UBS in a way. It's the past keeps on haunting it. What they really want to do is leave everything behind and just concentrate on their core wealth management business and on a slightly small investment bank.
Yeah.
But and now they have closed this final chapter, which will be a relief for them. But in September, the trial will start on the alleged unauthorized trading, $2.3 billion.
Yeah.
So that's going to, again, create really big headlines about UBS. Everybody will be asking the questions about their risk controls, about their compliance again, and how this all came about. So it's
huge work preparing for that trial, I guess. I mean, you know, from the UBS people I've talked to, it's the only thing that they're thinking about is preparing for that trial at the moment. Some people connected directly with it, obviously. But how long is it going to go on? What kind of ramifications are there going to be from it?
And I think it's going to carry on for quite a while. I don't know how long. I'm not very experienced. I think it's months. So it will be maybe 2013 even. So, you know, for UBS, it will mean also that from an internal perspective, it's going to be difficult. They've been trying since years to bring the fragile cultural relationship between the investment bank and the wealth management closer together. And talking to people inside UBS, they're saying, you know, we almost gotten there, and then the Quaker thing came, and reopened old rifts in terms of it. And that's just going to carry on during the trial and during when all these headlines will still be there, and it's you're just going to make internal refocusing more difficult.
Yeah.
It's also problematic in that usually the defense in unauthorized trading cases is, in fact, people knew what I was doing. The whole company's terrible. They all do it. So any evidence that Kweku Adeboli's lawyers can dig up of more unauthorized trading or other compliance failures will be fair game and will certainly be there out in the open. And that's certainly what happened in this case. There have been a series of cases involving this particular wealth management arm. And every time there was a hearing, there'd be some new horrifying detail.
Right. Mm. Well, I'm sure UBS will be very glad to get that final one out of the way.
Yeah, they definitely will
and
be.
Potentially unscathed come through that. We should move on to our second topic of Barclays. As a lot of our listeners will remember, I'm sure, when Barclays sold its old asset management business, Barclays Global Investors, to BlackRock, the giant US fund manager, a couple of years ago now, they retained as part of that deal a large stake in the combined business. But Barclays has said today on Monday that they are now going to sell the whole of that remaining stake, which I think is 20% or so of the fund manager, which is going to net them quite a lot of money. Is that why they're selling it? Because they need the cash?
No, I don't think that that's the reason. The main reason really why they're selling it is that under the incoming Basel III capital regulations, it's going to be just prohibitively expensive to own such a stake in another financial holding company. And I mean, it's basically, it will have a risk rating,
yeah,
of up to 250%. So it's really punitive to hold such a stake,
yeah,
under the incoming rule, which are going to be phased in from 2013. So it's quite timely to sell it now.
Yeah.
And the other element of it is obviously it was, you know, they got this in 2009, they did this deal. At the time it was to bolster their own capital base as well.
Yeah.
But this time it's for different reasons. At the time, they just created a deal with a cash and share structure, but it was never really their strategic aim to get a stake in BlackRock.
No.
and to have a stake in a fund manager. So it's a non-core operation.
Yeah.
So
it's strategically logical, but also capital efficient.
Yeah.
But,
and also, it's probably a sign of things to come. Part of the Basel III reforms are aimed at reducing interreliance of big financial companies so that if one goes bust, it doesn't take 17 others with it. So I think we will see other places where there are legacy holdings, where, you know, one bank owns a bunch of a fund manager or something like that, there will be more selling off because it is deliberately designed to be punitive. I mean, the risk weighting is to discourage this so that each tub will stand on its own bottom and won't take everything with it. Yeah.
Now, also, this was a minority stake, but we've seen, obviously, banks selling out of fund management subsidiaries. Deutsche Bank is going through something very similar at the moment, which I guess is a slightly different reasoning behind it, but I suppose we'll see more of that, will we?
Daniel? Yeah, I think we will. Yeah, quite a lot of banks have already exited some asset management business, but I mean, Deutsche will still, I think they'll, I mean, they've reduced their ambitions somewhat in terms of what they want to sell, simply because they didn't get the price they wanted for the whole package. But they're now selling one small part of it, which is called Reef,
yeah,
just their infrastructure arm. They're selling that. They might end up selling other parts, at least, for instance, the US retail business, which is part of the whole package they were trying to sell as well. So they might sell that. I mean, the other element for Barclays is that obviously the 20% stake in BlackRock, the share price has fallen in the past 3 years, and it didn't really yield much for them anyway. It was like, I mean, they had maybe a couple of percentage points of dividend yield, and that's it. If you compare that to, but it does bind capital. So, and if you compare that to their core businesses, which have a return on equity of,
well
last year
quarter,
owned all 6%, but
in the first quarter now more than 12, I think.
More than 12, so, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. So,
if that's the direction of their underlying business, then they probably want to focus on that rather than subsidiary holdings.
Indeed.
Good. Thanks for that, Daniel. Final topic is something you're very excited about, Brooke. I know the Bank of England finally, after what, 4 years, saying that they are going to review their own behaviour in the 2008 crisis. This is something that the FSA has done, something that the Treasury has done, but the bank, as the third element of the tripartite, always said, I don't know, that they didn't need to do it, or that there wasn't a case to answer, or that nobody wanted them to do it. But now now they're the court of the bank, which is this body that kind of oversees corporate governance there, really, has said they are going to do something.
They are going to do something. They've done it in a very interesting package. They're not just reviewing what happened in the crisis. Mm. They're doing three crucial reviews for their future responsibilities as bank regulators. And they're going to basically look at how they provided emergency liquidity assistance to all the banks that almost fell over in the UK and required government assistance. Mm-hmm. They're also going to... I don't think this is just a cover story. These are things that need to be done. But at the same time, they've announced reviews into how they're going to provide liquidity assistance in the future, mm-hmm. and a review into how the MPC does its forecasting. And all of those are, you know, things that need to be done. This is the court, which has been accused of being toothless, stepping up and actually trying to do something. They are bringing in outsiders to do the reviews. There's a former deputy governor of the Bank of England who's doing the review of 2008-2009. It's Bill Winter's former investment banking head at JP Morgan who's going to do liquidity assistance more broadly. And then it's an academic who's going to do the MPC review. All of this is very interesting because Mervyn King gave a very rare speech on the BBC earlier this month, basically saying nobody's ever asked us to review how we did. You know, we would do it if somebody asked us to. And what was interesting is the chairman of the Treasury Select Committee, Andrew Tyrie, immediately responded and said, well, we want you to do it.
Yeah.
And so this may be, in fact, they've called his bluff.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And what do you think they're going to find? I mean, obviously, it's going to take some time for them to set this up and to actually do the work, but it needs to be seen to be credible.
It needs to be seen to be credible. And certainly the FSA and the Treasury's reviews were both quite critical about failures that were made. It's interesting the way it's framed. It's how they provided emergency liquidity assistance. It's not how they managed financial stability, which is where the greatest failing people have seen from the bank. Because Bank of England always had a purpose of financial stability and did basically nothing but give speeches. Mm-hmm. And even those speeches weren't particularly effective. But the emergency liquidity assistance, there has been a lot of vocal criticism that they didn't step in fast enough, mm-hmm. and that they were very resistant to helping out anybody. And so, you know, I would think if they focus on that narrow issue, it's less painful in that it's a specific decision that was a difficult one. They can do a very credible review about here's what we could have done and how we should have thought about it differently without saying the people who run the bank are idiots who failed to live up to their responsibilities, because it was a tough call.
Yeah. And final thing, what do you think kind of changed their mind? What do you think prompted the court to take this decision? Was it just Andrew Tyrie kind of... saying something or what changed?
There's an ongoing debate about what they're going to do about the court. Mm. Because as you may remember, we're redoing our regulatory structure. And one of the issues that it remains live in the bill that is moving through Parliament that will do this is what kind of governance the Bank of England will have. And at the moment, it's calling for the court to stay in existence but be stronger. And this is assuming you're the court and you want to stay, this is an argument that really we can do the job. You don't have to reconstitute us.
We should see this as maybe proof of their resolve to
they're growing a backbone,
maintain the status quo, but with a tougher kind of profile. Thanks very much for that. All that's left for me to do is to thank Brooke and Daniel for their contributions this week, and thank you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.